to another episode of What's in Your Hometown. We've been gone for a while and we're back.
Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to a new decade.
Oh, God. God bless.
I was real God ready bless. For that last one to be over.
I'm so ready for this last decade to be over. Mm-hmm. I'm done.
Yeah.
What are some of the highlights of your decade? Because the highlight of my, I can tell you the highlight of my decade, Julia.
I went to go
run errands today, and while I was out, I was suddenly like not depressed for a second. I was like, I'm gonna go to a thrift store. I went into this thrift store, got a bunch of glass jars because I was inspired by these people living on a school bus.
That's bad. That sentence out of context is just not where you want to start, man.
So, like, I went and got all of these glass jars because I was going to be earthy and shit. And I went to go pay for them. And I told the lady my entire life story via these jars. All she said was, did you find something? I didn't know if you would find something. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna use this jar for flour and this jar for sugar and this jar for rice, and then in these little jars I'm gonna make overnight oats because I've decided to go on a diet. And like, I told her my entire life, Julia.
Oh, no.
And she didn't ask for any of it.
Oh, no. Aw. That's okay. I was a cashier for a really long time, and I always sort of appreciated it when people were excited when they came through my line instead of furious at me for no reason.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, maybe that was, like, a cool moment for her.
I hope so. Oh, my God, Julia. I could tell you the highlight of your year.
Please.
Of your decade.
Okay.
Finding out that your dog is Satan.
He is so.
Finding out he wants to eat baby Jesus.
He does. It's terrible. Okay, so it's Christmas. And listen, in West Virginia, it's Christmas until like mid-February when everything gets switched out for Valentine's Day. None of these decorations are going to come down. So at the end of our like stretch of road, before there's like a turn in the road, one of my neighbors has up this very beautiful, very large Christmas light display that's a crucifix and a star. And if you look at the star from a certain angle, because I can't tell if some of the lights are out or if it's like where it crosses over with the top of the crucifix or what it is, but the lights on this one certain part of it are out and it looks like a little neck. So it looks like, and then if you look at it from a steep enough angle, the points of the star look pretty round. So it just looks like a crucified gingerbread man. And my dog hates this display. And he will hide behind me and cross to the other side of the street and, like, bark at it. And we have to walk by it every night because I have to take him on a walk every night. And he's just, he's not thrilled with this whole situation. He doesn't like Christmas decorations. He's very upset about it. Yeah, but no, that was the highlight of my year, probably. The highlight of my decade was, you know, not to be sentimental or anything, but like legit the highlight of my decade was meeting you in law school and suffering with good friends for 3 years.
I was going to say that. I was going to leave off the suffering with good friends and everybody else. But I was going to say that as a joke when I said, I know the highlight of your decade. And then I was like, that sounds like a dick move. And now I'm genuinely like touched.
No, you're the best friend I've made this decade, and I'm so happy to have you in my life.
You've oh my God,
opened
girl.
Up so many new experiences for me, and I'm so happy. So
I love you.
Here you go. And I've had carbs tonight, so I'm being nice.
I love you so much.
I love you too.
Now that we've relived what the best moment of the decade is, what's your plans for the new upcoming year?
Well,
Do you know what I almost said? I almost said, what's your plans for the new millennia? And then I was like, wait a second.
Not quite. Hey, listen, if we could get a do-over on this one, I would sign up for that in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, we're a fifth of the way through it now, and that's enough. But no, I don't know. I never make New Year's resolutions because I just always end up breaking them no matter what.
Mm.
But I guess this year I'm going to make two New Year's resolutions that I will not feel so bad about breaking. The first being every single time that I take off a piece of clothing, whether it's to get in the shower or to change into pajamas or whatever it is, the clothes that I was wearing have to go into the laundry hamper and not onto the floor.
All right, because and tell me the adult. Realistic one.
No, that was the one I wouldn't feel bad about breaking, because that's just how I live. And then I think the other one is I do want to lose weight, and I do want to be a little bit healthier, and I'm doing okay with that, but...
You are!
Thank you. Yeah, no, I would like to maybe... not be quite so enormously fat by the end of next year.
You're not enormously fat. You're beautiful. But oh, I get what you mean. You want to feel more comfortable in your own skin.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for rewording that.
Yeah. Don't stop self-deprecating. No. Yeah. Won't allow it. Not in this. Honestly, not in this century. What the fuck is going on?
Decade. It's a decade. Samantha.
Decade.
Or a year. But no,
that's
I mean,
how long this decade has felt.
Listen, Nyan Cat happened in this decade. Nyan Cat was less than 10 years ago.
No, it was not.
It was.
Are you sure that wasn't in the dark ages?
I'm so sure. That's how freaking long this has been.
Oh my god. Okay, yeah, no, we need a new decade. We need a new decade.
Yeah, it's just too much. It's so much.
All right, I have one New Year's resolution that's like an amalgamation of a bunch.
Okay.
My New Year's resolution is I need to get... on a schedule for like habit forming. I need to be on a schedule because for the last, me and you have talked about this before, for the last 6 months since I've really been out here, I haven't had a schedule like I had in college, and it's taken a huge toll on my depression. And now I'm just super fucking depressed.
Yeah.
And so I need to get like on a schedule and back on my medication and go through it. So that's why I'm going to get on a schedule.
Good. I think that that's super achievable. And like, I also, the second that I lose my structure is when I start to spiral and get super depressed and anxious. Exactly. And I get like horrible intrusive thoughts. And it's just, it's not good for me to not have, okay, so at this time I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to have this block of time for something else. Like, it's just...
Yeah.
I need some sort of, whether it's self-imposed or externally imposed, like, I need something to do, I get so bad.
Yeah, I'm, like, the exact same way. And that's my New Year's resolution. Oh, man. Okay. Julia, what show is this?
This is What's in Your Hometown. And... After we've had a 20-minute long introduction of like general positivity, we're here to talk about creepy stuff.
We are the ooky spooky stuff.
We are. It's fun.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is What's in Your Hometown, where we talk about the dirty little secrets in your backyard. Yeah. I'm Sam. My co-host is the wonderful, beautiful, gorgeous Julia.
Oh, thank you, love.
Oh.
Yeah. No, we're good. We're so happy that you guys are here. I never thought that we would still be doing this. in the next decade.
It's a great, at this point, it's like a great way for me to get to see you.
It is. And it's really, it's so fun.
It's sort of strengthened.
It is. It's a good thing for our friendship. And I think it's a good thing for our listeners because someone decides that they should listen to us.
That's also part of my New Year's resolution is I want to do better by this show because I feel like with how busy we've been respectively starting our lives,
yeah,
the show's fallen a little by the wayside. And so I've done a shit ton of research for tonight's episode and I want to do a little bit better by the show. Not a little bit. I want to do better by the show.
I do too. And I think that that's a really good place to start.
So, all right. So tonight's show is going to be a little different than what it usually is. We've done it before. I'm going to be covering the content.
And I'm going to be the reactionary voice.
Yes. I decided to do an episode on vampires.
I'm so excited. I love vampires. I love vampire lore. I love vampires. Because, like, of course I was one of those assholes circa 2008. Who was
my God.
Twilight.
Listen,
but like,
I fucking loved that shit. And now I objectively know it's bad.
Of
not
course
even subjectively.
It is.
It's objectively.
No, it's
bad.
Objectively.
However,
yeah. But
that was the good shit back then.
Yeah. No, I liked it for what it was when I was reading it, and it was great. And I feel less shame than I probably should. But whatever.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
But no, I'm super excited to learn about actual vampires and like real mythology where they don't sparkle and where the protagonist is the most boring character in the series.
Yeah. Yep. So a little change from character. This episode will be split into two episodes.
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll have a part one and a part two. In part one, we'll look at old vampires, and in part two, we'll look at new modern day vampires.
That's very exciting.
Which are terrifying.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So the episode will be split in two. Also, just so you know how much research I've done, I looked up these names and how to pronounce them, and I have written notes. So then I can pronounce these names. I feel, take that in as you will. I hope it garners appreciation.
I appreciate it. I feel like that's, more effort than you had to put in. But I'm very excited.
Okay. Setting the mood now. Julia, go get Axel and, like, stroke him. Her little black cat, I need, like, the mood for vampires.
Here we go. Here's, we're gonna pretend like this is Axel that has fallen asleep on me.
Okay, thank you. I can't look at you now. All right.
Now he's looking at me like, fucking excuse you.
This was gonna be a serious episode, Julian. I don't know if I can pull this off now.
No, we'll get serious. Hang on. I'm going to go get a drink of water and then we'll come back and then we'll be really serious about it. I promise. Okay. Serious face.
Serious face. That's not water. That's the...
It's Le Chah.
I knew it and I was so angry for a second because I felt the lack of taste through the computer.
That's what I drink now because I'm on a diet. Okay. And I miss soda really bad. So if you drink it for long enough, you really can convince yourself that it's good. Like, it is a concerning phenomenon, and I'm on board with it for now because it's what I need to do, but oof.
Okay.
I'm drinking the grapefruit one, and I hate grape. This is like the gateway drug to a fruit that I despise.
I love you so much. We have to be serious.
Sorry. Okay. Regale me.
This is a disaster. Okay.
It's not.
Leave me alone. I have to be serious.
I'm sorry.
Oh God, we need to talk more often.
Now I'm looking down at the stupid cat.
Okay, we can't do this all night. So in 1897, a killer lurked in the shadows and minds of the Victorian, early Edwardian people. A soldier, a statesman, and an alchemist, he was handsome, charismatic, had a veneer of aristocratic charm. By the way, the last line came directly from Wikipedia, and whoever wrote that article did an A-plus job, because I would never in my life have thought to write a veneer of aristocratic charm.
That's amazing. I like it.
Right? And at the same time, was one of the deadliest characters to grace the cloth-bound pages of what is now one of the world's most famous monsters. Count Dracula is widely agreed to be the source or start of the vampire fantasy that continues to prevail within modern media. See, when you think of a vampire, you inevitably think of a Dracula-like character. But it won't come as a surprise. Vampires weren't always the sparkling cape-wearing night stalkers that they have been portrayed to be since the popularity of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Okay.
The Oxford English Dictionary dates the first appearance of the English word vampire or vampire from a travelogue titled Travels of Three English Gentlemen, published in Harleian Miscellany. My notes have come to haunt me. I don't know how to read them. and Harleian Miscellany in 1745. Harleian, yeah. English being a relatively new language, the idea of a word for vampire existed in German and French language long before it appeared in the English vernacular. So vampires were around before 1745. It's just they weren't part of the English vernacular at the time.
Okay.
The word vampire, or the German word for vampire, is traced back as far as the 10th century and is thought to have its origins in Slavic Europe. Medieval historian William of Newborough wrote extensively on vampires as early as the 12th century. It was Newborough that brought one of the oldest mentions of vampires to the public. See, he was the man who wrote about and embellished the Alnwick Castle vampire.
Ooh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So Northumberland hosts a number of medieval castles. One of the most famous among them is Alnwick Castle. The seat of the legendary Percy family, who are the original kings in the north, the old but well-preserved castle has a claim in modern fame as the castle from the incredibly funny show Blackadder and the wildly popular series Harry Potter.
Oh! Oh!
It's Hogwarts, bitches.
I'm more on board for this story than I thought I was going to mm-hmm. be.
However, its original claim to fame comes from the centuries-old legend that Alnwick spawned its own vampire. See, Alnwick Castle was built around the beginning of the 9th century, but it had apparently been the home to a vampire before Ivo de Vesey became Baron of Alnwick. So,
okay.
It was around before Alnwick sort of became Alnwick.
Okay.
And he was told that a former lord of the estate allegedly lived underground and emerged only at night to attack villagers. At the time of the lord's nightly wanderings, the plague was spreading through the town. So around the time the story popped up was around the time the Black Death
okay.
swept through
town. Ooh, that's creepy. So, mm-hmm. okay.
And the townsfolk attributed the cause to the vampire of Alnwick because they didn't understand the Black Death. The vampire was apparently a man who had caught his wife being unfaithful. Having hidden himself on the roof, when he caught her, he lost his footing and fell through the roof. As he fell, he cursed his wife and refused to repent for his sins, dying unrepentant. As the Catholic and you know, that's very, very bad.
It is super bad.
Yeah. So it was after his death that the plague hit the town. The following okay. days, the man was reported to be seen at night stalking through the town. One night, he visited the bedside of a lady who was later told to report the events to the brothers at the monastery. See, people became afraid to encounter the man and had begun to lock themselves in their homes at night. Then, one Palm Sunday, a local priest assembled a group of devout followers and prominent citizens who went to check where this man had been buried. When his body was uncovered, he appeared to have been gorged with blood. So much so that it oozed from his body when struck with a spade. The body was then removed from the town and burned.
Ooh.
That brought the epidemic to an end.
Okay. That's fascinating. As like a folktale.
Mm-hmm. So centuries later, William Naburo reported that the vampire was the reanimated corpse of the lord of the estate. So he embellished it a little bit. The vampire began his life as a man who caught his wife in bed with another. Her tryst was uncovered when this future vampire was seated on top of the castle while his wife was in congress with another man in the room below. During the act, the roof gave way and the man fell through, landing hard on the floor below. The wife immediately took to carrying her now severely injured husband. His wife declared herself innocent and claimed that his suspicions were just the result of his terrible fall. But he was so preoccupied with trying to piece together what he saw and whether or not his wife was actually unfaithful that on his deathbed, he forgot to confess his sins and therefore died unrepentant. From that point on, he was cursed to walk the earth and injured and now hunchbacked vampire.
Okay.
At night, maybe. This hunchback would rise up from the tunnels beneath the castle, which he inhabited, and wander the grounds of the estate looking for victims. On some nights, he would go into town and cause terror. Many blamed the recent deaths of the plague on the vampire, stating that the plague victims were actually just victims of the vampire. It wasn't until one Palm Sunday when a local priest, with all the enthusiasm of Buffy and Van Helsing alike, enrolled a pitchfork-wielding mob and successfully uncovered the grave of the dead lord.
Okay, but you say that, and all I want is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. And... just to actually be in that time frame with nothing about them changed.
I understand completely.
Okay, please continue.
So armed with torches, shovels, and pitchforks, the townsfolk removed the supposed vampire's bones from their burial site. Upon striking the putrescent body with a spade, blood gushed out, seeming to prove that the corpse had been feasting on the blood of the living. So the mob dragged the body from its grave, staked the putrid corpse with a spade, and then burned all of the... Okay, so they burned the ashes, but it says they burned the ashes at the margins of the village, which are either, like, the edges of the village or the crossroads of the village.
Okay.
And crossroads has more mythological meaning, so...
It does. No, I mean, devils and crossroads go together pretty well.
So for a long while, the curse seemed to be lifted. However, some have claimed that this evil specter still haunts the grounds, and he is still to blame for all of the town and castle's misfortune. The current Duke and his family still reside in a portion of the castle, but for those of you who would like to find out if the castle's other inhabitant still lives there, the castle offers tours throughout the summer.
I can go take a vampire tour at Hogwarts. Is that what you're telling me?
Abso-fucking-lutely.
Okay, I found a new New Year's resolution.
Yes.
That is what I want to do before this decade is out. Okay.
Me too, girl. I'll add that. I'll tack that on to my New Year's resolution, and we will get this done.
We're going. It's going to be fun.
We'll do a live stream.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, the vampiric image portrayed by the Onwut Castle vampire was the prevailing image of a vampire for many centuries to come, until, of course, the character is rewritten into the dark and charismatic Dracula. In European folklore, vampires are undead creatures that often visited loved ones and caused mischief or deaths in the neighborhood they inhabited while they were alive. Oftentimes, they were blamed for the deaths caused by the plague. Vampires were usually reported as bloated in appearance and ruddy, purplish, or dark in color. These characteristics were often attributed to the recent drinking of blood. Blood was often seen seeping from the mouth and nose when one was seen in its shroud or coffin. Its left eye would be open. It would be clad in a linen shroud it was buried in, and its teeth, hair, and nails may have grown somewhat, though in general, fangs were not a feature. So the early vampires didn't have fangs.
Ooh, okay. Hmm?
A stark difference from the gaunt, pale image of a vampire, which dates from the early 19th century, due to a prevailing misunderstanding of how human bodies decompose. Any fresh grave ran the risk of housing this creature of the night. See, as a corpse's skin shrinks, its teeth and fingernails can appear to have grown longer. The internal organs break down, causing a dark purge fluid to leak out of the nose and mouth. And of course, during decomposition, bodies bloat, making them seem like they have recently gorged themselves.
Yeah, I was going to say, while you were going through this, I'm like, that's just what bodies do, but I figured there would be something more remarkable about it or more exaggerated. But no, that's just decomposition.
That's just decomposition. So the blood that they recount, or the way that their hair seemed to have grown like they were still alive, and their nails seemed to have grown like they were still alive, it's just part of decomposition. But they didn't know that back then.
Yeah. Okay.
In addition, the plague ravishing the country left bleeding mouth lesions on its victims, and before their death, they suffered from hemoptysis, which is the coughing up of blood or blood-stained mucus from the bronchi, larynx, trachea, or lungs. This symptom is also present in tuberculosis, which we will see later was another disease blamed for vampirism.
Okay.
Or blamed on vampirism. Additionally, porphyria is another disease linked to the vampire legend, a blood disorder that can cause severe blisters on the skin that that are exposed to sunlight, so any patch of skin exposed to sunlight. Some of the symptoms of porphyria can temporarily be relieved by ingesting blood.
Ooh, creepy.
But at the time, the plague, combined with a basic misunderstanding of the human body, presented the world's first vampire. A slow-rotting corpse with a mouthful of blood that haunted the night, often bringing with it death by disease. But it's a big contrast from the vampires that you recognize.
It really is. That's a very different story than anything that I would associate with, like, Nosferatu or, mm-hmm. you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Something a little bit more modern.
So often during the Middle Ages, corpses were buried with rocks or other objects in their mouth to prevent the vampire corpse from eating its neighbors and further spreading the plague. In northern Germany, these corpses were called Nachtzehrer. That's right. Nachtzehrer. Because I've written a note, because when I heard it, I needed to know how to say it. I've written a note that it sounds like Nazi error, but with a k.
Okay.
Nachtzehrer.
Okay. Yeah. No, that sounds, according to your description, correct.
Or after devourers. They devoured their own burial shrouds before moving on to either eating their still living family or themselves.
Oh, that's creepy. What?
The more of themselves that they ate, the more of their family they physically drained.
Okay. That is a weird concept. Who came up with that? Like, I just want to hang out with them. That is terrifying.
Yeah, no, it's not good.
And they write Hollywood movies? That's scarier than anything that I've seen in ages.
I would watch the shit out of a movie like that. Mm-hmm. Like, just based around that premise. While the image of a vampire was pretty similar throughout the Middle Ages, this undecomposed corpse, there are several myths surrounding the origin or what makes a vampire. Now, in today's lore, vampire bite is a precipice for transformation. Not so for the original vampire. The Nachtzehrer is created most commonly after suicide. Most German lore doesn't see a person become a vampire after being bitten or scratched. The transformation happens after death and is not communicable.
Ooh, okay.
When it came to the plague, Nachtzehrers were the first person who died from the plague, not the rest.
Okay. That's fascinating.
Cultures such as the Mesopotamians, Hebrews, ancient Greeks, Manipuri, and Romans had tales of demons and spirits which are considered precursors to modern-day vampires. In Slavic and Chinese traditions, any corpse jumped over by an animal, particularly a dog or a cat, was feared to become one of the undead.
Okay.
And there's a whole section of vampire lore that they have familiars.
Yes.
Like, for instance, they can turn into a bat, or I think owls is another one. Like, I know there's familiars in witchcraft, but I think it's pertaining to vampires as well.
Yes.
A body with a wound that had not been treated with boiling water was also at risk. In Russian folklore, vampires were said to have once been witches or people who had rebelled against the Russian Orthodox Church while they were alive. Despite the occurrence of vampiric creatures in these ancient civilizations, the folklore for the vampire's origins almost exclusively placed them in the early 18th century southeastern Europe. So despite all of these old folk legends, they weren't gathered and written about until around the 18th century.
Okay, that sort of makes sense, especially in that area of the world, just based on the not much that I know of how history and folklore mm-hmm. there was recorded. Just with, like, the unification yeah. of Germany and, like, that sort of mm-hmm. timeline.
And in these recordings, vampires were revenants of evil beings, suicide victims, or witches, but they can also be created by malevolent spirits possessing a corpse. Vampires were the result of an evil life, and everyone was at risk, even a chaplain.
Ooh, that's creepy.
Mellor's Abbey was founded by a colony of Cistercian monks in 1136. Although it was one of Scotland's wealthiest monasteries, it suffered badly in the wars that ravaged much of the Scottish borders in the medieval period. And while it holds many claims to fame, it also holds its own vampire.
Okay.
The Vampire of Melrose was, during his lifetime, a chaplain to a lady who lived nearby. Unlike the holy idea that precedes a chaplain, the chaplain of Melrose was fond of all manners of sin and vice. He was nicknamed the Hundepriest, meaning dog priest, both because of his nature and because of his favorite sport was hunting on horseback, followed by a small pack of howling hounds, instead of focusing on the spiritual matters that made up his job.
Okay, cool. So, like, just a total slacker.
Yep.
Not a terribly pious priest.
Nope. Okay. In Stories of the Border Marches, John Lang says, other things he also loved that made not for sanctity, and when at last he died, his death was no more holy than his selfish, sensual life had been.
Ooh.
Quite the Ooh. Obituary.
Really?
Mm-hmm. All right. When he died, he was buried in the graveyard of the abbey. And the Scottish borders, but because of his wrongdoings, his soul could not find peace. It was said that he tried to enter Melrose Abbey in the form of a winged bat or of a dark vampiric creature. The prayers and rituals against the devil kept the monks of the abbey safe from the newly risen monster. Forced away, the revenant roamed the countryside, making terrible noises until it reached the bedchambers of his former mistress.
Ooh, okay.
It was reported by the nearby neighbors that the vampire roamed about the dwelling where he moaned and screeched to her. Which I don't know why that's so funny. But I see like Gary Oldman's Dracula, but like with the winged body from Van Helsing, that really bad like he's Wolverine.
Jackman?
I almost said Hugh Grant. Yeah, Hugh Jackman. That Van Helsing, the Hugh Jackman Van Helsing movie, where it's like a bat body, like a giant fleshy human bat body, but Gary Oldman's head.
I am here for this. I love this interpretation, and I think we should go with it.
Yes, that's what I see, and I like it. Okay.
Yes.
Where was I? Alarmed.
As you should be.
Why wouldn't you be? Sorry, alarmed, she went to the monks. The townspeople also turned to the church for solutions to their plight, and the monks generously and eagerly answered their pleas. They summoned an elder monk from the abbey to investigate the Hundepriest vampire. The elder monk that was summoned brought along a fellow monk and two other men, both novices, and began the investigation. They decided to watch the former priest's grave, hoping to find any signs of the beast terrorizing the townspeople. As the last glimmer of daylight died away, The priest arrived in the guise of a vampire and appeared to levitate out of his deep grave, pushing his gravestone from his sight.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The frightening phantom began to approach the trembling monk at an alarming rate. And that's what is written.
Oh, God, I would be so freaked out.
I'm still just seeing Gary Oldman's head.
The more you talk about this, the more I love it.
So, quickly recovering, the monk lifted up his staff and smote the figure again and again. The vampire retreated back to his grave, which suddenly opened with a terrible sound, swallowing the hunterpriest back into the earth.
Okay.
The elder monk immediately knew he was dealing with a vampire, because how could you fucking not?
Really? No, what logical explanation is left? Because that... Jesus Christ.
He ordered the grave exhumed on the first light of the coming morn. Upon the opening of the grave, the hunterpriest vampire was lying in his coffin, dead to the world, with a bloody grin upon his lips.
Ooh, creepy.
The elder monk ordered his companions to remove the body, place it on the ground, and burn it. The monster's corpse was thrust into a fire, reducing it to ashes that were then carried by the wind over the Lammermuir. I think I got real close with that one, because my note is Lammer, but in like little parentheses, like hammer.
Okay.
Lammermuir.
Listen, you've seen the phonetic pronunciations that I have in my notes. Yours seem more instructive, really.
The Lammermuir heals to the north along the Scottish borders. Another version of this legend has the monks at the abbey arming themselves and hunting the former chaplain. On the night of the operation, the armed monks gathered at his tomb before three peeled away to warn others in nearby houses. No sooner had they passed from view than the revenant appeared to the remaining monk and rushed upon him with a terrible noise. The monk made a mighty axe strike against the figure, who retreated back to his grave. In the morning, the four friars gathered again at the tomb where the corpse of the hunterpriest was found, the blood still flowing from the wound.
Oh, ooh, that's creepy. Ooh.
The monk then removed the body, cremated it, and scattered the ashes to the wind.
Good.
While supposed great men fell to the vampire epidemic because of their poor life choices, most often it was a villager that rose from the grave and terrorized the neighbors. Such is the tale of Grando.
It's just goals. That's, if I could rise from the dead and terrorize the neighbors, I would.
Sold.
Like, I've got a couple really good neighbors right now, but some of them...
It doesn't even matter. If you had that power, you'd use it against anybody.
I would, you're right. But I feel like there would be an order to things. Like, I would get to the people that I liked last.
Exactly. You would try and hold yourself back before screaming wildly into the night. All right. Jur Grando was a villager in the region of Styria, which is modern-day Croatia, who lived sometime during 1579 and 1656. Now, he may have been the first real person described as a vampire in historical records.
Okay.
So he is referred to as a strigoi, a local word for something resembling a vampire and a warlock. Legend has it that Jura died in 1656 due to illness, but for 16 years after his death, he would arise from his grave by night and terrorize the village. 16 years.
16 years? Are you kidding me?
He would flit around knocking on doors in the dead of night, and whoever lived behind the door he knocked on would die within the next few days.
Oh, that's creepy.
So not only do you wake me up in the middle of the night... You also kill me in a few days? Just get it over with. Just, if you're going to wake me up, bring
it. Right? Don't let me agonize for a few days like, oh, was it just like some shitty child trying to play a prank on me, or am I about to die?
You will die in 7 days. Bitch, just come here now. Why do I gotta wait?
Like, thanks for giving me 7 days to get my affairs in order, but, like, I don't have any assets. I can't. There aren't a whole lot of loose ends for me to tie up.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. He also appeared to his terrified widow in her bedroom. She described him as a corpse, looking as though he were smiling and gasping for breath. He would then assault her. So this isn't a nice vampire story.
No.
After 16 years, the village had enough.
Why did it take them 16 years to get fed up with this? What were you doing?
What were you doing?
What other problems did you
Stop
have?
Stop dying of the plague.
Okay.
The bravest of the villagers, led by Prefect Miho Raditek, chased and tried to kill the vampire by piercing his heart with a hawthorn stick, but failed as the stick bounced off his chest. Apparently, after 16 years, you're just fucking immortal. The next night, 9 people went to the graveyard carrying a cross, lamps, and a hawthorn stick. They dug up Jura's coffin and found a perfectly preserved corpse with a smile on his face. So this one really should look how they want him to look.
Yeah.
When they open that coffin lid. And he doesn't.
Oh, okay.
The village priest, Father Gorgio, looked upon the bemused corpse and cried, "Look, Strigon, there is Jesus Christ who saved us from hell and died for us. And you, Strigon, you cannot have peace." And this did shit all.
Okay, wait, I'm sorry. Sometimes I need detours in these stories.
Go for it.
So you waited 16 years, and then your idea was to show up with a picture? And then that was gonna fix shit?
Look at Jesus!
You're in a cemetery. Is Jesus not already in the cemetery? What were ancient cemeteries like? I thought he was around places.
I thought it was, like, near the church. I thought cemeteries were... All I know about cemeteries comes from a shit you know, I read Dead Redemption.
Okay, so I have spent a fair bit of time in cemeteries and graveyards, which is very different. But, like... Every single one I've been to, and I admit most of them have been Catholic, but every single one that I've been to, Jesus is in a lot of different places.
He's within us all, Julia.
Okay, but like externally. You can't walk into a cemetery without seeing like 7 or 8 different Jesuses.
Your dog would fucking die.
We can't take him with us. Terrible idea.
Oh my god, okay. Oh shit. So the albeit small mob then tried to pierce the heart of Jor, but the stick could not penetrate his flesh.
Why are y'all still bringing sticks? I thought sticks already didn't work.
So Father Giorgio, I think, continue chanting exorcism prayers, hoping to weaken the undead nightmare. And then one of the villagers took a saw and sawed off the head of the corpse. As soon as the saw tore at his skin, the vampire screamed and blood started to flow from the cut, filling the grave with fresh blood.
Okay, that's the only effective thing that I've heard in this whole story so far. Well, you brought a saw. What are you doing with sticks?
Yeah, nope, yeah. I don't know what to tell you.
I'm sorry. I'm getting hung up on the wrong details of this story, but it's just...
No, you are getting hung up at the exact... Wherever you want to get hung up is the exact right place.
Okay, so okay. Good on the exorcism. That's probably an important step in this. Good on the saw, because really, that should have been, once the stick already didn't work, don't come back with more sticks and then hope that they will work later. That's not how sticks work.
Do you think it was like... Because, you know, the women were home tending to the babies. So do you think it was like a bro dude moment where they brought the stick and like the first dude that tried to attack him was like, dude, Jerry, it won't work. And he's like, you just didn't like, you didn't do it right. I know
I'm
you didn't
so right. sure that's what happened. It's just, it's the, there's like a video that's been going around Reddit forever of these people trying to like smash the glass at a bus depot and they just can't. Oh my God. It's just that.
Yep, yep. Okay, let's see. So after that, the Honorable Nine, or the nine villagers that set out to kill the vampire, closed the grave, and since that day, the village has reveled in peace.
Well, good.
There are many methods to dispatch of a vampire. There are preventative measures, such as burying a corpse upside down or placing a wax cross and a piece of pottery with the inscription Jesus Christ Conquers on the corpse. Other methods including severing the tendons at the knees or placing poppy seeds, millet, or sand on the ground at the gravesite of a presumed vampire to keep the vampire occupied all night by counting the fallen grain. So like a boo hag.
Okay. I like the tendon cutting one. That seems like
that's the best one.
Yeah. Seems effective.
So to destroy a vampire, the truest method is was and is staking.
Yes.
An ash stake was the preferred wood in Russia and the Baltic states, hawthorn in Serbia and oak in Silesia. Aspen was also used for stakes, as it was believed that Christ's cross was made from aspen.
Okay.
So potential vampires were most often staked through the heart, though the mouth was targeted in Russia and northern Germany and the stomach in northern Serbia. The belief behind staking was that piercing the skin of the chest was a way of deflating the bloated vampire. So, I mean, it's going to kill you. Anything going through your chest will kill you, but it'll also do, like, defloat him.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they're... Or deflate. That gas isn't going to be trapped anymore. It has a way to get out of you.
And in a lot of places, it was also a demon or a violent spirit could possess you, so that could be seen as, like, the spirit leaving.
Okay.
So, decapitation was the preferred method in German and Western Slavic areas. The head would then be buried between the feet or behind the buttocks. Further measures included pouring boiling water over the grave or completely incinerating the body. In the Balkans, a vampire could also be killed by being shot or drowned by repeating the funeral services, by sprinkling holy water on the body, or by execution. Anything can die by being shot and drowned.
Listen, if you get shot and then drowned and then you don't die, you're really not supposed to. Like, that's
like,
just...
Like, goddamn Rasputin. Yeah.
Yeah, Rasputin wasn't supposed to die. Rasputin had a lot to offer the world. And those stubborn bastards took him from us.
Girl, no, he was so disgusting.
Of course he was, but can you imagine the fucked up shit we would still be talking about today? Those are good stories 100 years later.
Oh God, the orgies.
Yeah. How fucking hilarious is that?
Okay. So in Romania, people liked steel, as evidenced by the 800-year-old skeleton found in Bulgaria that had been stabbed through the chest with an iron rod.
Ooh.
Hmm?
Staking. That's way more resource intensive. So
right?
They're serious about it there.
They're badass. It's Romania.
Good for you.
Staking as a method of dispatching a vampire is incredibly ironic considering the preferences of Romania's most famous vampire, Vlad the Impaler. Part of the inspiration behind Count Dracula, Vlad III Dracula was born in Transylvania, Romania. He was the second son of Vlad Dracul, who became the ruler of Wallachia in 1486. The name Dracul translates to Vlad the Dragon. The elder Dracul received the name after he became a member of the Order of the Dragon, which was a religious order tasked with defending the cross and fighting enemies of Christianity, in particular, the Ottoman Empire. So when I found this, I was like, oh my God, is like all of that one Tom Hanks movie true? Angels and Demons and The Da Vinci Code. Is it all true?
Part of why it was so good is because they took a lot from actual history and just sort of tweaked it a smidge.
So after a meeting with John Hunyadi, the regent governor of Hungary and the voivode of Transylvania, which is the highest ranking figure in Transylvania, in which Vlad Dracul did not support the Ottoman Empire, he was ordered to come to Gallipoli. Vlad and his younger brother, Radu, accompanied their father. Upon arrival, all three were imprisoned. While their father was released at the end of the year, Vlad and Radu were kept as hostages to secure the great Dracul's loyalty. They were kept more like prisoners than hostages, and their lives were constantly in danger. None more so than when their father supported Vladislaus, King of Poland and Hungary, against the Ottoman Empire during the Crusade of Varna in 1444. So for reference, the boys were imprisoned in 1442. Their father led a raid against the Ottoman Empire in 1444.
Okay. Good plan.
In their father's defense, he was convinced that his two sons had been butchered for the sake of Christian peace.
That seems like a good reason to be mad at somebody.
Yeah, so the raid makes sense because he didn't think they were alive.
Yeah.
But also it was back then, so he could have just been like, I don't fucking care. Let's attack the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
Had like 18 more children. However, the boys were very much alive and suffering for their father's ignorance. In 1446 or 1447, Vlad Dracul again acknowledged the Sultan and paid him a yearly tribute. The boys were presumably released, as it is later reported that they fled from Wallachia when Hunyadi broke into Wallachia in November of 1447. So they were released, lived there for a hot second, and then Hunyadi broke in.
Okay.
Because Elysians were not a thing when Dracula roared at Wallachia.
No.
So Vlad Dracul and his eldest son were murdered during the invasion, prompting the younger Vlad to take his father's name and become Vlad Dracula. He was also known as Vlad Tepes or Vlad the Impaler. Hunyadi installed Vlad's second cousin, Vladislav II, as the new voivode. Hunyadi launched a military campaign against the Ottomans in autumn of 1448, and Vladislav accompanied him. Vlad broke into Wallachia with Ottoman support in October. So now he's got Ottoman support. But okay. Vladislav returned, and Vlad sought refuge in the Ottoman Empire before the end of the year. Vlad went to Moldavia in 1449 or 1450 and later to Hungary. So Hunyadi broke in, installed his cousin, kicked him out. He broke back in, didn't have enough support, and ran. Relations between Hungary and Vladislav later deteriorated, and in 1456, Vlad invaded Wallachia with Hungarian support. Vladislav died fighting against him, making Vlad the ruler of Wallachia. And to strengthen his claim, he began to purge among the Wallachian boyars, who were nobility at the time, that had participated in the murder of his father and elder brother. So he just killed them all.
Okay.
He later came into conflict with the Transylvanian Saxons, who supported his opponents. Dan and Basarab Loeta? They didn't have a translation for this one. Okay. Dan and Basarab Loeta, who are Vladislav's brothers, and Vlad's illegitimate half-brother, Vlad the Monk.
Y'all have got to lay off this junior situation. This is too much. There are too many Vlads in this story. This is early 2000s baby naming, where everyone is Jason or Ashley. Like, just quit.
As a result, Vlad plundered the Saxon villages, taking the captured people to Wallachia, where he had them impaled. So he ruled Wallachia off and on from 1456 to 1462. Now, this is when all of the stories about Vlad the Impaler came out. So there's one story that the Sultan sent two envoys to demand that Vlad pay him tribute like his father had. So Vlad had the Sultan's two envoys captured and impaled. In February of 1462, he attacked Ottoman territory, massacring tens of thousands of Turks and Bulgarians.
Oh, that's not good.
Which ultimately spelled his downfall as Mehmed launched a campaign against Wallachia. Vlad went to Transylvania to seek assistance from Matius Corvinus, who, like Vlad, really liked torture.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also the king of Hungary. Let's see, Haunted Places, the podcast Haunted Places, have a really good episode on Matius or Corvinus. I recommend it.
Nice.
He was quickly imprisoned upon arrival and was held in captivity from 1463 to 1475.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
That is a long time. So he was eventually released and fought for Corvinus against the Ottomans in Bosnia in early 1476 and was killed in the battle before January 10th, 1477. Okay. So overall, he was considered a just but brutally cruel ruler who fought off the Ottoman Empire. He earned his nickname because his favorite way to kill his enemies was to impale them on wooden stakes. And according to Meistersinger Michael Beheim, Vlad had two monks impaled and to assist them go to go to heaven. He also ordered the impalement of their donkey because it became braying after their master's death.
Oh, no. Dude, that's not... Like, okay, I understand that should not be my reaction. I should be very, very sad. And I am very, very sad about every human being who has died in the context of the last 3 to 4 minutes that you've been talking about this dude. However...
The donkey did nothing.
It's an innocent little animal who was just real upset because its favorite people got hurt.
Died.
And then you're going to fucking impale a donkey?
Yep. Oh, wait. It gets worse. Well, no, I think the donkey's the worst it gets, but it gets relatively worse to other people.
Okay.
So Gabriel Rangoni, Bishop of Jaeger, Bishop of Jaeger. My notes say think of it like pronouncing it like Jaeger. Bishop of Jaeger.
Okay.
Recorded the rumor that while in prison, Vlad caught rats to cut them up into pieces or stuck them on small pieces of wood. Antonio Bonfini, author of Historia Pannonica, recorded some of Vlad's more tyrannical forms of justice. In one instance, Turkish messengers came to Vlad to pay respects, but refused to take off their turbans according to their ancient customs. Whereupon, he strengthened their custom by nailing their turbans to their heads with 3 spikes so they could not take them off.
What the fuck?
A German article titled About a Mischievous Tyrant Called Dracula. He was described as having had a big copper cauldron and put a lid made of wood with 3 holes on top. He then put people in the cauldron and put their heads in the holes and fastened them there. Then he filled it with water and set a fire under it and let the people cry their eyes out until they were boiled to death.
Fuck that. No, that's awful. What on... How is this dude looked on as a just ruler? The fuck did he do right?
That's a German article and a Turkish story. So just wait.
They're just like different strokes for different folks, mm-hmm. I guess. But
well, he then invented frightening, terrible, unheard of tortures. He ordered that women be impaled together with their suckling babes on the same stake. The babies would fight for their lives at their mother's breast until they died. Then he would have the woman's breasts cut off and he would put the babies inside head first. And thus he would have impaled them together.
No. No.
However, many Romanian artists and accounts of the famously cruel man paint him as a just ruler and a realistic tyrant who punished criminals and executed unpatriotic boyars to strengthen the central government. So the crux really is between how Romania remembers him and how the Anglo-Saxons and the Ottoman Empire, or the Transylvania Saxons and the Ottoman Empire and all of these people see him.
Okay. I mean, so. Yeah, like, that makes sense, and there's a lot of, like, ancient propaganda that goes into this, and I'm sure it's very complex and very political, and, you know, you of course you do have different perspectives based on where you come from, but, like, dude,
right?
Maybe once people impale nursing mothers with their children after mutilating them, maybe don't think of them as a good guy.
Well, it's not, you don't know if that's actually happened. It's just what the Germans said happened.
It's still pretty bad.
Poet Dmitri Ballantyne emphasized Vlad's triumphs in his battle, in his Battles of Romanians. He regarded Vlad as a reformer whose acts of violence were necessary to prevent the despotism of the Boyars. One of the greatest Romanian poets ever, Mihai Eminescu, dedicated a historic ballad, Third Letter, to the valiant Prince of Wallachia, including Vlad in his story. He urges Vlad to return to the grave to annihilate the enemies of the Romanian nation state. So it says, "Oh, come, oh, you must come, all dread and paler, confound them to your care. Split them in two partitions, here the fools, the rascals there. Shove them into two enclosures from the broad daylight in asile them. Then set fire to the prison and the lunatic asylum."
That's dark. That's real dark.
Still, according to legend, Vlad enjoyed dining amidst his dying victims and dipping his bread in their blood.
Yeah.
So it was in these stories about Vlad that made him the best known medieval ruler of the Romanian lands in Europe. However, Bram Stoker's Dracula, published in 1897, was the first book to make a connection between Dracula and vampirism. So nobody considered him a vampire until Dracula.
Yeah.
Stoker had his attention drawn to the blood-sucking vampires of Romanian folklore by Emily Gerard's article about Transylvanian superstitions, published in 1885. His limited knowledge about the medieval history of Wallachia came from William Wilkinson's book entitled Account of the Principalities of Wallachia and Moldavia with Political Observations relative to them, published in 1820, which has got to be the driest fucking thing to read that you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, no, that doesn't sound like a good, you know, cozy up next to the fire and enjoy your night kind of book.
Yep, yep. So, Stoker apparently did not know much about Vlad the Impaler, and certainly not enough for us to say that Vlad was the inspiration for his Dracula. Stoker's main source. Oh my god, I've been calling him Stoker.
I didn't even notice, because that was what I called him always, because I hated that book.
Stoker's main source pertaining to Wallachia and Dracula, William Wilkinson, accepted the reliability of the German stories that described Vlad as a wicked man. Actually, Stoker's working papers for his book contained no references to the historical figure at all. Instead, It's theorized that Stoker borrowed the name and scraps of miscellaneous information about the history of Wallachia when writing his book about Count Dracula. In fact, the idea of Dracula more likely came from the American legends, particularly those surrounding the New England vampire panic.
Ooh, okay.
In the late 18th and 19th centuries, the belief in vampires was widespread in parts of New England, particularly in Rhode Island and eastern Connecticut. The panic was mainly a reaction to an outbreak of tuberculosis.
Okay.
So tuberculosis, sort of like the plague, had those mouth lesions.
Mm-hmm.
See, tuberculosis was thought to be caused by the deceased consuming the life of their surviving relatives, which relates back to the legend of the Noxier.
Okay. That's fascinating.
You can see why. Like, at the time, tuberculosis was known as consumption because it appeared to consume an infected person's body. It spread easily among the family, and the cause was unknown.
In an attempt to protect the survivors and ward off the effects of consumption, bodies of those who had died of the disease were often exhumed and examined. An age-old tradition, usually fresh corpses, especially those whose heart or other organs contained blood in them, were determined to be vampires. So after the culprit was identified, there were a number of proposed ways to stop the attacks. The most benign of these was to simply turn the body over in its grave. In other cases, families would burn the fresh organs and rebury the body. Occasionally, the body would be decapitated. Affected family members would also inhale smoke from the burned organs or consume the ashes in a further attempt to cure the consumption.
There's just something about decapitation that, like...
It's effective.
It is. But it's just, like, it's just one of those, like, primal sort of, like, I hate it responses.
Yep. I get it completely. Now, you can tell, like, you can see how the idea of consumption being a vampire came about, because it was like, it was all these old legends, especially because that area is primarily settled by, like, Dutch German.
Yeah.
So you had all those old legends. And then tuberculosis really does consume you. I mean, it just withers you away before their eyes, and they didn't understand what was going on. So in 1990, a group of children playing near a hillside gravel mine, because it's the fucking 90s. Do you remember? Okay, so you know how, like, My Favorite Murder and John Mulaney will talk about, like, growing up in, like, the 80s and the 70s.
Yeah.
And how you could do absolutely fucking anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
We got
to
tell the end of that in the 90s. Because I remember, we did. Like, my dad, we used to go four-wheeling or RTVing, however you want to say it. But we would go in the, like, in the back of the woods of this property that somebody my dad knows owned. And it was, I should not have gone with him. It was some rough shit. It was like, there were so many times I had to walk around, like, just holes in the earth so that they could take the RTVs past those holes in the earth. So, like, it was some rough stuff. And you came out at the end, and at the end of this whole trail that we made ourselves was an old abandoned coal mine.
Yeah.
And I just ran around and played near the old abandoned coal mine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was a child, I went from being very small and dealing with very large animals on a normal basis, unsupervised, and in a field half a mile away from anyone who could hear me scream, to, like, one time I was 15 minutes late coming home, and it was, like, the end of the fucking world, and, it was somewhere right in there where children got to be, like... precious, I guess. I don't know.
You know how many times, like when we were younger, you would just see people in the back of a pickup truck, like in the bed of a pickup truck, going like 80 miles per hour on the interstate.
Yeah, all the time.
You can't do that shit anymore.
No, I saw that the other day, and I'm like, holy shit, you're gonna die.
Yeah, no, it was a different time. It really just really was. So, this group of children was just playing on a hillside gravel mine. And they came across graves. Now, that's graves, plural. One kid ran home to tell his mother, presumably while the others fucked around with these graves, because it's the 90s.
Right.
You know what? Not even it's the 90s. If I was a child now and I find a grave, I'm just going to be like, what is this? I must touch everything. Why does this feel gross?
Can I jump on it? Can I jump off of it? Or there things to play with? Are we?
Exactly. So, now the mother was skeptical at first, because of course she was. My mother watched me fall out of a tree and did not believe that I fell out of a tree.
Yep.
She still doesn't believe I fell out of that tree. I did. It hurt. I remember.
That's fine. My mom didn't believe me that I fell off of the seesaw. And it was in the middle of, like, a 4th of July party that she was hosting, so we couldn't go to the hospital because she was busy. And then it was, like, 3 weeks later, and I'm like, y'all, my wrist really still hurts. And they're like, well, we can't take you now, so good luck with that.
Oh, my gosh. Our childhoods were wild.
Yeah.
So the mother was like, oh, yeah, Billy, that's great. And then he produced a human skull.
So, oh!
What I like about this story is before running home to tell his mother, he grabbed the skull.
He grabbed the skull and was like...
Because he was the only one that ran home. So presumably he was like, this is a little weird. I think I'm going to go tell an adult. And he was like, wait, let me just take this with me.
Wait, she's... I know she's not going to believe me about this shit. No, I need evidence.
This is the 90s. She won't believe me. Let's just take the skull.
We don't believe children. It's a terrible idea.
Now, this is a quote. Now, and I quote, because this was Griswold, Connecticut in 1990, police initially thought the burial sites might be the work of a local serial killer named Michael Ross. So they taped off the area as a crime scene.
Okay.
However, the brown decaying bones were much older than they expected, centuries older. Connecticut State archaeologist Nick Bellatoni soon determined that what the children had found was a colonial-era farm cemetery. New England is full of such plots, and the 29 burials the kids found were typical of the 1700s, early 1800s. The dead, most of them children, were laid to rest in what the article calls a thrifty Yankee style.
Okay. Sure.
I just realized coming from my accent some thrifty Yankee style.
It just sounded like an insult. And I don't think it was really supposed to be. I don't know, maybe it was.
It could have been like a thrifty Yankee style.
Yeah.
But instead I chose automatically to say it as a thrifty Yankee style.
It sounds either like an insult or like a look that you would wear to Coachella.
Yeah.
There is no in between.
I need it now. I need us to start the thrifty Yankee style. Not us. I'm too Southern. You might be able to get by with it.
Maybe. I don't think so.
Anyway, which was a simple wood coffin, no jewelry or much clothing at all, and their arms would either be crossed over their chest or at their sides. Just simple style.
Yep.
That is except for burial number 4. Burial number 4 was one of only 2 stone crypts in the cemetery and was partially visible from the mine's face.
Okay.
After carefully working away at the soil with flat-edged shovels, brushes, and bamboo picks, the archaeologists worked through several feet of earth before reaching the top of the crypt. When Bellatoni lifted the first of the large flat rocks that formed the roof, he uncovered the remains of a red painted coffin and a pair of skeletal feet in what he later recalled as perfect anatomical position.
I don't really like the way that that's described.
But when he raised the next stone, Bellatoni saw the rest of the individual had been completely rearranged. The skeleton had been beheaded. The skull and thigh bones rested atop the ribs and vertebrae. It looked like a skull and crossbone motif, a Jolly Roger. He says, I'd never seen anything like it, Bellatoni recalls. A subsequent analysis showed that the beheading, along with other injuries, included a rib fracture occurred roughly 5 years after death.
Oh.
So somebody had also smashed the coffin.
Ooh, creepy. Okay.
So the coffin and its contents were shipped to the National Museum of Health and Medicine in Washington, D.C. for further study. Bellatoni started networking. He invited archaeologists and historians to tour the excavation, soliciting theories, because they didn't know why that particular coffin was like that.
Mm-hmm.
Simple vandalism seemed unlikely, as did robbery, because of the lack of valuables at the site. It was a mystery until one colleague finally asked him, ever heard of the Jewett City vampires? In 1854, in neighboring Jewett City, Connecticut, townspeople had exhumed several corpses suspected to be vampires that were rising from their grave to kill the living. The setting was right. Griswold was rural and bordering South Rhode Island, where multiple exhumations had occurred. Many of the other vampires, like the Griswold corpse, had been disinterred.
Disinterred.
No, wait. I think I just saw the ghost in my apartment.
Oh, no. God damn it, Samantha. Get the broom.
That
I sort of want to cry. It might just be like I dipped my head too far and I saw the lights, but it was like, you know what it looked like? I have an oil diffuser over there. It looked like a puff of like condensation, but the fuse was off.
Oh, I don't like that. That's a bad deal.
Let's see. Many of the other vampires, like the Griswold corpse, had been disinterred, grotesquely tampered with, and reburied. See, tuberculosis had swept through New England in the 1730s, a few decades before the first known vampire scares. But tuberculosis was a long-standing plague. In fact, tuberculosis, which is a bacterial-based disease, it wasn't until 1882 that they even knew that it was a bacteria-based disease. Ooh. So they had no fucking clue what was causing it.
No.
So by the 1800s, vampire scares were at their heights as the disease was the leading cause of mortality around the Northeast. It was also responsible for almost a quarter of all deaths, and it was a terrible way to die. It was a consumption in every sense of the word, often drawn out over years with skyrocketing fevers, a hacking, bloody cough, and visible wasting away of the body.
Mm-hmm.
In an 18th century description, someone wrote, "The emaciated figure strikes one with terror, the forehead covered with drops of sweat, the cheeks painted with a livid crimson, the eyes sunk, the breath offensive, quick and laborious, and the cough so incessant as to scarce allow the wretched sufferer time to tell his complaints."
Yeah, no, tuberculosis is a horrible way to die. Mm-hmm. And it is a scary, scary disease.
Yeah, it scared the shit out of people. And since no one knew what caused it, they were desperately searching for reasons. And that is the tale of Mercy Brown. See, the Brown family lived on the edge of town in a modest homestead. In 1882, Mercy's mother, Mary Eliza, succumbed to this consumption. Mercy's sister, Mary Olive, died the next year. And within a few years, Mercy's brother, Edwin, who was described as a big, husky young man, fell ill. In a desperate attempt to save his son, Mercy's father sent the boy to Colorado Springs, hoping that the climate of the area would improve his health. Then came Mercy. Now, she didn't fall ill until nearly a decade after her mother and her sister were buried, and it's speculated that her tuberculosis was the galloping kind, which meant that she might have been infected but remained asymptomatic for years, only to fade fast after showing the first signs of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So, as Mercy was on her deathbed, her brother was taking a turn for the worse. He had returned from Colorado in a dying condition. When Mercy died, neighbors fearful of their fates started making suggestions. Several approached the father, George Brown, and offered an alternative take on the recent tragedies. Perhaps instead of the sickness eating away at the family, an unseen diabolical force was preying on his family. It could be that one of the three Brown women wasn't dead after all. Instead, they were secretly feasting on the living tissue and blood of Edwin.
Oh, I hate like the obviously sexist undertones of this, but go for it. Okay, we're good. This is not the time for that soapbox. We're in the middle of something. It's very important.
The neighbors soon convinced a desperate George to let them exhume the bodies. His whole family was gone at this point. It was his son, and that was left.
Yeah.
So he was like, okay. I don't want to, but Jesus. Okay. So on March 17th, 1892, a party of men dug up the bodies as the family doctor and a journal correspondent looked on. George was absent for unstated but understandable reasons. After nearly a decade, Mercy's sister and her mother were barely more than bones. Mercy, who had only been dead a few months in the winter, wasn't nearly as decomposed.
Mm-hmm.
A correspondent later wrote, "The body was in fairly well-preserved state. The heart and liver were removed, and in cutting open the heart, clotted and decomposed blood was found. The villagers reacted immediately. They burned her heart and liver on a nearby rock and fed Edwin the ashes. He died less than 2 months later."
Jesus, that's gross. Okay.
Now,
I think it is important to note that during the impromptu autopsy done on Marcy, the doctor emphasized that Marcy's lungs showed diffused tuberculosis germs, that they were still there. And the people were just like, no, vampires.
Yeah.
That's vampires. We're going to go with vampires. And so Mercy Brown became the first American vampire, and the vampire craze officially hit America. It was memorialized in the New York World newspaper. And a clipping of that article was found in the personal papers of a London stage manager after his death. His theater had been touring America in 1892. When the Brown family made news, he read the story and saved the article. And years later, he went on to write the sensational story that cemented vampires in that public eye. Dracula. So here's the thing. Mercy hasn't left entirely. She's rumored to frequent a certain bridge and manifest herself as the smell of roses.
Ooh, creepy. Ooh, super creepy.
And that is where we will end today. I'm going to save all of my sites until the end of episode 2. So there were a lot of them. Lore was a big one. And then haunted places and different articles. I will let everybody know where I got them and give those people credit, but it's all jumbled up right now because I expected to do it all in one and then realized I wasn't going to be able to. So all the sources are just together and I don't know which ones go to this episode and which one are going to the next one. So I'll say them all at the end of the next episode. But that is the end of the first episode on vampires.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing. Ancient vampires are creepy AF. Mm-hmm. And I don't like them one bit.
Nope.
But no, I really die. Liked. You're gonna die. You're being haunted. We knew you were being haunted. And okay. Now okay. We just know more. And yeah, how that works. So it's gonna work.
All right. I'm good. I love you.
Okay. I love you too.
Thanks. Just
so you know, before you're definitely gonna die.
I'm trying to think of like any reasonable explanation for what I saw, and I just
there is one, I'm sure. You'll be fine.
Okay, so I'm not gonna die. Yes, it was there's a lot of information.
Yes.
But it's all it's very interesting to see what we started out with and where we've come.
Definitely, because a lot of that was so radically different than what I mm-hmm. associate with vampires. And just to know that it's a legend that's endured for so many centuries and across so many cultures, that mm-hmm. by itself is fascinating.
Oh, yeah. No, it's very interesting. Okay. Where can the people find us, Julia?
Everyone can find us anywhere that you guys find the Civilized Creatures. They're at Civilized Creatures on Instagram and Twitter, I think. But if you just search for Civilized Creatures Entertainment Network, you will find us wherever we are. You can find us specifically, though. We are at WIYHT on Twitter, and we're at What's in Your Hometown on Instagram. And we have a Facebook page that I still have not set up and don't post too regularly, but it's there. And we have views occasionally. It's very nice.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and
we appreciate you.
We do.
We're sorry.
We do, and we are. And but if you have suggestions for episodes or suggestions for topics, please, please, please write into us at whatsinyourhometown@gmail.com. We really, really love hearing from you.
And we're going to say this until we do them. We're still like looking at like the stories that you've sent into us. We see them. We appreciate them. We're working towards them. It's just we have a few episodes planned beforehand.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you, by the way, to everyone who has reviewed us on iTunes and who has subscribed and who has done wonderful, people have wonderful reviewed things for us. Yeah. We've got good reviews.
Oh, okay.
Well, I wouldn't be thanking them if they were assholes about it.
It depends on if you're a funny enough asshole.
True. Anyway.
Like, I love sarcasm like a motherfucker.
Oh, God, I do too. It's amazing. But no, thank you to everyone who's done that. It really does, you know, it validates us so much. We love it and we love you.
Instantly, I'm like,
And yeah, no, that's where you can find us, and we look forward to hearing from you.
And I guess all that leaves is, with all the weird, crazy shit in the world, you have got to wonder
what's in your hometown.
Bye.
Bye-bye.